who, I don't know, they stole it from. Board syndicates, government of the earth, pay. Pay back the color you stole. Pay back red. Pay red. Pay back the red you stole for your lying flags and your Coca-Cola signs. Pay that red back to penis and blood and the sun. Pay blue. Pay back the blue you stole and bottled and doled out in eyedroppers of junk. Pay back the blue you stole for your police uniforms. Pay that blue back to the sea and sky and eyes of the earth. Pay green. Pay back the green you stole for your money. And you, dead hand stretching the vegetable people, pay back the green you stole for the Green Deal to sell out peoples of the earth and board the first lifeboat and drag. Pay that green back to flowers and jungle and river and sky. Board syndicates, governments of the earth, pay back your stolen colors. Pay color back to Hassani Sabah. It's just like a little tiny sketch in which he's actually taking the abstract colors and the blue, the police uniforms.
Hassani Sabah?
Hassani Sabah is, is a character that goes in and out of boroughs, a hashishin, during the Crusades, mysterious Arab who lived in Mount Alamut, somewhere, I guess, in Persia, and sent out hashish-maddened assassins to do his errands and re-regulate the politics of the planet, of Europe. How many of you have read some of Burroughs? And how many have not? So very few have not. So maybe I'll read a page or two that's exemplary for, see if I can find some stuff that's exemplary for clarity of pictures and clarity of details. The Intolerable Kid is a character who goes around making trouble for everybody. This is a sort of cut-up of very concrete, specific images. I said that the basic techniques of Nova, that is to say, blowing up the universe, starting a nuclear war which will blow up the universe, the basic techniques of Nova are very simple, consist in creating and aggravating conflicts. No riots like injustice directed between enemies. At any given time, recorders fix the nature of absolute need and dictate the use of total weapons, like this. Collect and record violent anti-Semitic statements. Now, play back to Jews who are after Belsen. Record what they say and play it back to the anti-Semites. Clip, clap, you got it? Want more? Record white supremacy. This is like a Jesse Jackson right now. Record white supremacy statements. Play to Negroes. Play back answer. Now, the women and the men. No riots like injustice directed between so-called enemies. At any given time, position of recorders fixes the nature of absolute need and dictates the use of total weapons. So leave recorders running and get your heavy metal ass in a spaceship. Did it. Nothing here now but the recordings on Earth. Shut the whole thing right off. Silence. When you answer the machine, you're provided with more recordings to be played back to your enemies. Keep the whole Nova machine running. The Chinese character for enemy means to be similar or to answer. Don't answer the machine. Shut it off. The subliminal kid took over the streets of the world. Subliminal kid is a kid that goes around making subliminal suggestions toward violence and aggression. A major character in Burroughs is always creating wars. Took over the streets of the world, cruise cars with revolving turrets, telescope movie lenses and recorders, sweeping up sound and image of the city around and around, faster and faster, cars racing through all the streets of image record. Take, playback, projects on walls and windows, people and sky, and slowly moving turrets on slow cars and wagons, slower and slower, record, take, playback, project, slow motion, street scene, now fast, now slow, slower, stop, shut off, no more. My writing arm is paralyzed. His writing arm was actually, it's an old junkie's phrase for somebody who got a doctor who writes out morphine prescriptions for you. He's got a great writing arm. My writing arm is paralyzed. No more junk scripts, no more word scripts, no more flesh scripts. He all went away. No good, no bueno. Couldn't reach flesh, no glot, Plum Friday. It's from an old Chinese laundryman saying, no glot your laundry, come Plum Friday. Through the invisible door. Adios, Mr. William, Mr. Bradley, Mr. Martin. I have said the basic technique creating and aggravating cabinet officers. At any given time, dictate total war of the past. Change place of years in the end is just the same. I have said the basic techniques of Nova reports are now ended. Wind spirits melted between enemies. Dead absolute need dictates use of throat bones. On this green land, recorders get your heavy summons and are melted. Nothing here now but the recordings may not refuse vision in setting forth. Silence. Don't answer. That hospital melted into air. Into this he's cut up a phrase of Shakespeare. These are players as I foretold you, all actors, and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the insubstantial fabric of this pageant faded with the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, yea, the great globe itself shall dissolve and leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made of, made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. You all know that?
Yeah.
Shakespeare line. Actually, I saw in the New York Times, at the center of our galaxy, they've now determined, is a black hole, which actually would make sense in terms of Shakespeare. That would mean whatever is here is like this big floating dream which will disappear, just like in Shakespeare. Burroughs look like he's on his way, or anybody seen sight of him?
No, well, not quite.
Yes. Are they trying to drag him?
Sort of.
Yes, okay.
Silence.
Don't answer. The hospital melted into air. The great wind revolving turrets, palaces, towers, insubstantial sound and image flakes fall through all the streets of time for him to forbear. Blessed be he on your... Oh, he's cutting up Kaddish now. Blessed be he on your walls and windows, people and sky, and every part of your dust slowly, softly falling into the dark mutinous no more. My writing arm is paralyzed on this green land. Dead hand, no more flesh scripts. Last door, shut off Mr. Bradley, mister. He heard your summons, melted into air. You are yourself, Mr. Bradley, Mr. Martin. All the living and the dead, you are yourself. There be. Well, that's about the closest way I know to tell you in the papers rustling across city desks. Fresh southerly winds a long time ago. September 17th, 1899 over New York. And that's the end of a novel. The end of Nova Express. Actually, it's not very much exemplary of what I was talking about at all. What it is actually is a cut-up of those details. Good deal. Mr. Burroughs?
Just again.
Mr. Laurel?
Mr. Hardy?
Wait a minute.
I was just reading from a Payback. What I have been discussing was... specificity of detail, minute particulars, concrete, specific, particular facts as the life of prose, and had said that at one time you said that you primarily thought in pictures, and so that most of your prose was... a good example of concrete picture images, and then opened and read Payback, and then wound up reading some of the end of Nova Express, the cut-up of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering, what would be a good passage which would exemplify detail? And I thought this one. You know, we ate the s'more broth with hot chocolate.
Yeah. There's a phrase from Conrad, I believe, called bits of vivid and vanishing detail. We drank the beer and ate the s'more broth. I dropped half a sandwich in my lap, and she wiped the butter off with a napkin, laughing as the cloth bowled under her fingers. Well, vivid detail. In other words, the way that you, well, suppose you walk into a room, you're the writer, and you start picking out details, the first details that meet your eyes. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you pick up descriptions of people. What is the first thing about the person that attracts your attention? What is the first thing about the room that attracts your attention?
Okay, so when you walked in here, what did you notice? Or what did you actually consciously check to see that there was a detail, for any detail?
Oh, of course.
So you make a practice of doing that, wherever you are?
Well, not sure.
Does anybody else do that? I don't. I walk around half unconscious. And so I'm really astounded, actually picking up, reading my collected works, I realize how, because I'm putting together collected poems, I realize how little real detail there is and how little I notice. Then opening up Burroughs's 3 volumes, I'm amazed by how much actual precision there is.
Yeah.
But I, years ago you said you did constant practice of awareness practice of checking out detail.
Oh yeah, walking down a street and seeing everything on the street and then coming back and thinking also what you were thinking when you saw this detail or that detail, these intersection points between what you were thinking and what you saw. And you will often see that how significant these intersection points are.
Well, your original interest was in the synchronicity and the nameless synchronicity and ominous sense of what of the intersection points.
Well, it's not necessarily ominous. It is simply that these intersection points are significant. You're thinking about something, and all of a sudden you look up there, and there is what you were thinking about in deep time.
How constant is that practice? In other words, when you walked in here, you said you checked out for a detail. Do you remember what it was you saw?
That?
Painting?
I don't want to embarrass a young man here, but...
Okay. Which one?
A young man with black hair.
Yeah.
I just have to
Peter Timmis.
Yes.
Peter Timmis was here last year.
Pick out
How come him?
Well, how do I know?
So it's. But then, how do you notice what you noticed?
What do you mean, how do you know?
Now, how do you remember the first thing you noticed when you came in the room?
Well, unless your memory is completely flawed, you remember what you have seen when you walk in the room. Just like, now, for example, you get 5 people walking down the street, and suppose all of those people had cameras in their eyes, and we will see what they saw. Well, you got five people there, and then you project onto a screen what five people saw, and it will not look like the same street, because they were all seeing different things for various reasons. Well, now, I set up these exercises that will train you to break down your automatic selection of details by having an arbitrary selection of details. For example, you walk down the street and you pick out all the blues in the street, all the greens, all the reds. I've had some extraordinary things. I'm picking out reds. So, God damn it, I'm sticking on reds, and then suddenly a red car will come up from behind. A blue car.
Could you explain that as an exercise that we could do for homework?
Well, certainly. Walk down the street and pick out colors.
How many blocks?
As many as you want.
The first walk of the day, or a specific moment you set yourself out to do that?
Whenever you want.
Everybody follow it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure, it's very simple.
So,
there are many others.
So, which you divide it into a blue walk, a green walk, a red walk?
Oh, no, you keep shifting them.
Yes.
You keep shifting them. I would say, well, now I'm on blue. Blue cars are coming up. Then you'll see a red over there. Shifting to red. Shifting to orange.
Within the same red. Within the same walk. Within
of
the
course.
Same
walk.
Okay. No, I never understood that.
Of course.
I thought you would go on one walk, which would be just all blue.
No. Good God. You shift it all the time. You know when. Wait a minute, I'm running out of blue here.
Okay.
Time to shift your red.
So then what you would be doing would be notating the blue objects or the things on the walk, and then the red. And then noting on paper, or noting in the mind and then taking back to the house.
Noting in the mind, you can't notice on paper when you walk in.
Well, you could carry a notebook or a tape machine. No. Have you ever tried that?
Of course. Yes. Many times. And you'll often find that it's very interesting. You find that there's something that you, when you play the tape back, you'll often find there's something you didn't notice at all. Mm-hmm. It's quite loud on tape.
Yeah. You mean a noise, are you speaking of, or a comment?
Well, what else would you hear?
Well, now to reduce this to a classroom assignment, that would be then to, for the next class, to take a walk following these directions.
Simplest way is simply to walk around the block or whatever perimeter.
Burroughs used to start at the Varsity Townhouse.
Doesn't matter where you start. All right, you come back and put down on paper what you have seen and heard with particular attention to what you were thinking when you saw a certain object, when you saw a truck pass, when you saw this happen. The intersection points between your inner reality and the outer reality. That's the simplest. Then you can, as I say, you can do it on colors, which is a further extension of that. That is, you're moving on colors.
The first one would then be not working with colors, but whatever main object you saw on the walk, or whatever main objects you saw on the walk, and what intersecting thoughts? What subjective thoughts? So that's the first exercise.
What subjective thoughts? The intersection between your subjective experience and what you were seeing that very moment. And you will find that these are often very significant indeed.
And the second exercise was with color?
Well, it's one.
Yeah.
You can do it with color. You can...
What else? You developed a lot of these here, didn't you? Or was that intentional?
Oh, no, I developed these for years. Another one is to walk down a street and try to see everyone on the street before they see you. When you do that, you will often find that they don't see you. They won't see you. You're making yourself invisible by seeing them before they see you. This is what I learned from an old mafia don in Columbus, Ohio. He claimed nobody could ever see him before he saw them.
So that would mean paying particular attention to the people on the street and checking them out constantly as you're walking, or being completely aware of everybody else moving around on the street.
Well, not sure.
With your eyes up and looking around and not drifting off.
Because most people, you'll ask people who lived on the street for years, what is the next shop down, et cetera, and they don't know. The whole thing comes under the head of keeping your eyes open, which is a very good practice for a writer. Because some writers don't have to keep their eyes open because their eyes are going inwards, like Beckett. There's no dichotomy.
Anybody have any comments or questions?
Yeah. Do you write every day? And for the days that you do write, how long do you usually go for in a stretch?
Sometimes I'll write every day and write for 5 or 6 hours. Some days I may not write at all. I don't have any rules. In other words, I don't say that I sit myself down and I have to write for so many hours, because I find that to force yourself to write if you don't feel like it is very unproductive. See, the difference, all right, between writing, okay, a lawyer may not really feel like trying a case, or a doctor may not feel like seeing patients, but he can do it. But if a writer doesn't want to do it, he can't do it. The results will be lamentable. He has to want to do it.
How do you define the concept of discipline as it applies to writing?
Pardon?
How do you define the concept of discipline as it applies to writing?
There's no discipline. With regard to writing, other than the discipline of simply making yourself available, as Henry Miller said, who writes the great books? He said, not the people who have their names on the pages. They have simply made themselves available. They simply made themselves available to various cosmic currents.
That's a quote from him, or I saw Phil had that written down in a little sheaf of papers today. Did you bring your cut up?
No, I didn't.
What did you cut up recently?
Some stuff from Dead Roads. Basically, I did a pre-Baron collage where I would take one sentence beginning with Kim, and then I would go something else with, like, it. Because it seems you have a lot of things beginning with Kim and it. Kim, and then I'd say something with it, like something about, I don't know, wildcat or something, smelled terrible, something like that, or the yellow tadpoles in the deep stream or something like that. I would go with that, and then I'd come back with Kim, saying, like, if you went each one with Kim, it would be like a continuous story. If you went every other one, if you went every other one with the other one, go with kind of a story. I didn't really pick out a special selection of sentences. I just picked something of interest, basically, for the reader.
Well, but if someone is making a cut-up, they look through a book, and the selection they make is already a cut-up. And then when they start cutting that up, that is a further degree of randomity. You see, life is a cut-up. Every time you look out the window or walk down the street, you are exposed to random processes.
Anything coming in.
Yeah. Anything coming in.
What just came in?
Yes.
Jim Honeycutt in an explosion.
Yeah. The idea that, you see, a writer doesn't write in a vacuum.
Yeah, he doesn't suck it in, it comes into him, maybe, right?
Yeah.
How come you got so interested?
In what?
In that aspect of writing, or mind, or perception.
Just doing basically whatever I want, you know? Just taking in anything from my past experiences, putting it together in some different way.
Do you write that way yourself? I mean, is that your form of writing?
Yeah, sometimes. Usually creative. I don't like to do the, let's say, you know, from other people's things, not unless it's imaginative like his, you know, but, you know, I like to explore something new, you know. If it makes me think, I usually like it. If I look at a piece of art and it inspires me to do more art, I usually like it, you know. I keep looking for things that, you know, inspire me and make me feel good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, that's the way I work. If I go, like, reading a book of poetry that turns me on to start writing, then
yeah.
I think almost everything. You do that a lot, I
think. Sure. Well, you see, the painters had the whole representational position knocked out from under them by photography. There's never been anything like that that's happened to writers, but you have this, representational painting. Here you have someone standing, sitting in front of the thing that he's painting, and he is the whole perspective of time is left out. Suppose instead of been sitting there painting the cows and the grass or whatever he's painting, he'd been moving. And then he can be moving at differential speeds. And there you get a montage, that is to say a blur. You have pictures, a car cutting a street sign in half, and reflections from shop windows and so forth. So actually the montage method is closer to the actual facts of human perception than this so-called representational painting.
Yeah.
I read where you had said that you couldn't stand your own writing until you were about 25. What was the change then?
Oh, that's a terribly difficult question to answer. It's one of the writer's block is the inability to endure what you have written. And I would say any writer has to do an incredibly amount of very bad writing before he can do any good writing. I have destroyed at least 1,000 pages. I mean, just out and out destroyed. Often, when I write a book that's 200 pages, there will probably be 600 pages that didn't go into the book that may go into another book. And then there'll be a whole batch of stuff that was so awful it just has to be destroyed.
Why does it have to be destroyed?
Because it's terrible, you know. Sinclair Lewis said, you've written something, and you think it's just great, and you can't hardly wait to show it to someone. He said, tear it up, it's terrible. And I have found that to be true. Tear it up into very small pieces and put it into somebody else's garbage. Yes.
What do you think about when you rewrite? Or do you rewrite?
Oh, rewrite, my God, yes. I will figure to rewrite any passage about four times. The first is just sort of a rough sketch, and then I get closer to it.
Would you overwrite the first sketch?
Pardon?
Would you like write everything you think of and then cut it down from there?
Not exactly. I'll make a first sketch, and then I'll start rewriting, and I'll correct the first sketch, and then rewrite it again. And it usually takes three rewrites.
Retype. Write the first sketch, correct it, then retype.
Yeah. Well, I make the first sketch, then often correct it in handwriting,
yeah.
And then do it again. Now, Kerouac always said that the first thing is always the best. I said, well, Jack, it's bullshit. It may work for you, but it doesn't work for me. I have to get it. If I presented my first sketches, they'd be terrible. And I think Wolf was another of the youngest.
Yes, well, except he was edited. He was edited.
No.
Wolf was edited. I find myself half and half. Depending on the first sketch and then blue penciling later.
Oh, sure.
But not much reconstruction, just blue penciling.
Yeah. Well,
nothing else.
I don't know. There are
a little bit of transposition.
There are only hard and fast rules, but I do an awful lot of editing and an awful lot of drawing out. Got any more questions?
More.
What about your sense of time in your novels? You like to twist it also. Like using different, the montage with time as well as space?
Well, of course, time is a very mysterious factor, but I use, like, here you have the representational painter, He's sitting in front of the object, painting, but time is suspended there. And as soon as someone moves, you have a whole different concept of time. He can move slowly, or he can move quickly. You say if he's moving quickly, you get a blur of trees, or a blur of this. Your time is a very, very important aspect. Yes.
Whose paintings do you get into?
Huh?
What paintings do you dig? What painter?
Many, many. Brian Garson, I think, is the only painter of the space age who has
Brian Garson.
And he will show a picture where you have solid cars and barren cars, and this is simply the factual condition. You're walking down the street you've walked down many times before, and you have, here are cars that were there 10 years ago, phantom cars, and here are cars that were there 2 years ago, and so on. You're seeing this whole spectrum of time from space. You're looking at time from a spatial position. Yeah.
Right before we came here, we were sent a copy of an article. I think Joe Ritchie wrote it, and there was a reference to a comment you made about copying out being a one-shot deal.
What?
About copying out being a one-shot deal.
Yeah, Leary was in that class. What was it? What
selling
was it?
Out.
Selling out.
Selling out. That's it.
I don't quite follow.
But last year, in the classroom, you were talking about Hemingway having sold out by allowing The Snows of Kilimanjaro to be made into a movie with a fake ending.
Well, sure. He sold his soul to Hollywood.
And then...
Nothing complicated about that.
And then I think you said that once you had done that, there was no way back or something. I forgot what it was. It was irrevocable or some such comment.
Well, it was pretty irrevocable. Well, yes.
And then Timothy Leary was in the class and said, and what was his question? You remember he asked a question? At that point, he asked the question as if a guilty thing appraised. Right. You remember that?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, that was what was so funny.
What?
Yeah, you were there.
Is there a way back?
Yeah, you didn't even notice that, I bet.
I don't
Leary raised
there.
His hand just at that point in the class and said, "Is there what was it?" I think.
If you sell out, is there a way back?
And you probably didn't notice it was Leary because then you said, "Nope." And that was the end. So it was a very funny moment. You didn't notice.
No, there's not much.
Were you there? And who was anybody here in that class? Suddenly, me and Effie. I remember that very clearly. I was a little shocked, actually.
No, the thing, the point that I was making is, here is Hemingway, who knew more, had more feeling for death than almost any other writer. He could smell it. He lets Hollywood take one of the great stories about death in the English language, which is The Snows of Kilimanjaro, and tap a Hollywood happy ending on it. They come in with penicillin, which wasn't even invented at that point. And I think it was disgusting because it could have been a great story about death. Terrible.
Why did that strike you?
Well, there was no Hemingway story in it. It was just a comment about selling out being a one-shot deal, the mention of Mary raising his hand, and you said that was it, was just that short excerpt.
Yeah.
And it,
yeah.
No, actually, see, I didn't think, when you said your curt no, there's no way back, I think you weren't aware that Leary was perhaps asking in his own case,
right.
And you were so much involved with thinking about Hemingway, you may not have even noticed it was Leary asking the question at that point. At least that's what I thought. Mm. Yeah?
How did you and Laurie Anderson get involved to do Sharkey's Machine when her legs
out? Oh, well.
I just heard that. That's right.
No. She simply wanted me to read this Sharkey piece. I didn't write it.
That's her writing?
Of course. Yeah. I had nothing to do with it at all except to read it. She asked me to read it, and I read it. That's all. It was her piece, not mine.
Where'd you read it? Where'd you do it, in a studio?
Studio.
Which one?
How do I know, New York? Studio.
So Peter Livingston is a writer agent. So we have this big giant manuscript by Brian Geisen.
Oh.
Do you want to try taking it around?
I'd like to take a look at it.
He's also got The Process, which needs a novel by him that needs recycling through publishing again.
Yeah, it's a very great book, and it's out of print and should be back in print. The other book is difficult in a way. It's sort of a Finnegan's Wake, but I think a very great book. And a very beautiful book. And I certainly would like to see it published.
Did you have any agents look at it? Or?
Yeah. Well, the only one was...
Manson.
Well, Manson didn't want to do anything about it. And Philip Wiley...
Andrew Wiley.
Didn't feel that
he could
represent it. Yeah.
You've been getting book lists from everybody else. I'm curious as to who you would recommend to read.
Well,
someone said, just as you came in, someone said he was reading Conrad. Who was that? Yeah, oh, that's right.
Yeah. Well, all sorts of people. Jane Bowles' work.
Jane Bowles?
Jane Bowles, Danton Welch, who's pretty much out of print, he's one of the principal influences on my own work, is Danton Welch. Danton Welch is Kim Carson, and there's some others like Julian Green. And, well, let's see, I didn't bring along my list.
Actually, we have, you have your old list. Brandy has a copy of her old list.
Oh, good.
Would anybody be interested in seeing that?
Yeah.
What is that, a list of neglected or
well,
basically?
Well, some of them are neglected and some of them aren't. Yeah. Conrad, of course, and Conrad wrote two books in collaboration with Ford Maddox Ford, one called Romance and one The Inheritors.
How are those?
They're quite interesting.
Look, you know, Basil Bunting says that he was his secretary between the two of them when they were doing that, and that Basil Bunting had actually put them together.
Okay.
To do the real writing. No, they to get.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He got fragments from them and actually put them together. Uh-huh. And he's still alive in England. But I didn't know they were that fragments.
Basil Bunting.
Yeah. Still. You never met him. I know. No. He's like a really great mouth. Great pronunciation. Great diction. Most elegant English diction imaginable. What else?
I can't.
Rambo.
Well, good God.
Denton Welch.
Yeah, we had him.
Denton Welch.
Yeah, Julian Green, Denton Welch so far, Jane Bowles.
Hobo.
Julian Green.
Hobo.
Hobos.
Hobos, for God's sake. He's written some great things like, let it come down the sheltering sky. And some of his short stories are very special sort of atmosphere, like underexposed film, very sinister, and very special for Paul. Let me see.
Is there any text of Kerouac that you check back at occasionally? Do you ever read him for pleasure at all?
Yes, The Bounty of Deleuze.
Yeah, that's very sharp.
Quite something.
Deleuze.
Huh?
Deleuze. Kerouac, Deleuze.
Yeah.
That's Kerouac's last big, long book.
Yeah.
A sort of retrospective judgment on his own life.
Mm-hmm.
And visions and illusions. Mm-hmm. How come you like that? Because it's so dry?
Yeah, well, no, it just seemed to sum up. He said there something a great deal about the position of the writer. I am a spy in someone else's body. Everything about me is a fake. In other words, the writer is nothing but his work. Everything else is fictitious.
As a writer, do you feel yourself adopting different personalities easily? Like, you yourself being this way for a while?
Oh, yeah. See, I, as a writer, I have no personality of my own, no ego of my own. I'm I can write in the style of Conrad, Graham Greene, all sorts of people.
Try out different personalities.
Well, I don't mind, which probably I don't.
Yeah. What made you decide to become a writer?
Well, it was sort of an accident. Somebody suggested to me that I should write my experiences as a drug addict, and I did it. I wrote this out, and then it was eventually published, and then went on from there until eventually a writer has no other context than his writing. Yeah.
When you described the experiment of walking down the street and noticing random details, just say the red details that stand out to you, what are you reaching for? Are you trying to just to not be as locked into the details that your consciousness would be?
You're not reaching for anything. You're just seeing what happens. What you actually notice, that's all.
Do you find that maybe after doing that, you notice different things in the street?
You have a different what?
That you end up noticing different things on the street.
Yeah, yes. If you have an arbitrary exercise, say, of noticing, then you'll begin to, it's sort of a, expands your area of awareness. You start really looking around and seeing what's going on, what you're seeing.
But I'm curious, when did you start that kind of exercise? Before you started writing, I bet.
No. Really? Yeah. Although,
so was it motivated by writing, by needing
much
to make?
So now, Someone asked Jean Genet when he started to write, and he said at birth. But I think this is true. Even though you may not be aware of it, you're doing all these, making all these observations that will later, even though you don't know that you're going to be a writer, these observations that will later be used in your life.
I'm wondering, when did you consciously begin directing your mind toward the practice of observation?
Oh.
And make, and begin making games or
I wouldn't be able to
exercises?
Say, I wouldn't be able to say that.
I don't remember back at all. There were some kinds of things you were doing back
then. I wouldn't be able to say that at all.
When you were rolling drunks in the subway, I seem to remember you had developed a couple of criteria for who would be susceptible. I think you or Phil Whitehead, some criminalist types, had criteria for noticing who could be a John or who could be a Mark.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that's the first I remember of it.
Sure. And this whole similarity between writing and spying, which are very much the same. That is, you've got to watch what's going on. You see the spy said, you see the same person twice. Look down at his shoes, because often they don't change their shoes.
The purpose of that would be to make sure that it's the same person, or to check, or to get some mnemonic device?
Oh, no. For a spy.
Yeah.
For the spy, it is that a watcher, someone following the spy, he will change his clothes, but he won't usually change his shoes.
Right.
He wants the shoe.
Yeah. If someone's spying on you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And he changes his clothes so that you're not quite sure it's him, then check out the shoes for the mark. Do you remember any of the criteria for rolling drunks in subways? How you could tell whether somebody was going to be the right kind of victim?
Oh, well, lost.
I seem to remember that was the first time I
thought. Are they half asleep or whatever?
Whose idea was it? Phil White's or Hunky's?
Phil's. You gotta watch. I would hold the New York Times out. He's working behind my back, you see. But there's even a rhythm of snores, as you can tell. A rhythm of snores when they're going, they're about to come up on you. Brings on my ulcers to think about it. God Almighty. Well.
Yes?
Yes.
I'm aware that, psychic phenomena interests you and also plays a part in your work, but I know people also have different definitions of what they include and what is psychic phenomena and what is ordinary things. I'm curious as to your definition of that.
There isn't any definition. For example, all right, these people that run, they're trying to isolate it, but that's ridiculous because psychic phenomena don't exist in a vacuum. There's all the, the body language and everything else if you're, say, face-to-face with the person. I don't think you can isolate these things at all. But the point about psychic phenomena is that they're not rare, that they happen all the time, and that everybody who is good at anything uses it. I read an article by a cop, and he was describing what he called his survival IQ. All right, he stopped a guy for a traffic offense, and dignified, middle-aged man, he's reaching over for the glove compartment. Lots of people keep their
registration,
driver's license. All of a sudden, he knew something was wrong. He rushed over there, ripped the door up, and dragged the guy out. And he had a gun in the glove compartment. He knew somehow that something was wrong. And he gave a number of other instances where he just knew that something was wrong. And I think that it's just a common phenomenon.
Do you think it's a matter of then therefore opening up your awareness as through simple things just like this exercise and stuff, as far as just more or less being tuned into?
Well, someone who's on the edge, that is, where their life depends on it, will develop this awareness. And he gave a number of instances like that where he just knew that somebody had a gun in his pocket or this or that. He could see it. A good doctor knows what's wrong with someone as soon as he walks into the room. So,
can you tell me some of the things you learned in Tangier while you lived there about yourself and people that you might not have learned from?
Oh, my God. Well, I've learned about Arab music, about Arabs and how, where they are, that they know who they walk down the street and they know where everyone is in that town. They would know that Paul Bowles is on his way to the post office. They would know what fruit was in town, who had brought them in, by what was in the market, and so on and so forth. Well, I can't begin to tell you all the things I learned from being in Tangiers and living among the Arabs, because they're aware of everything that's going on. Unlike, you say, people like living in a big city like New York or something, they don't know anything. They don't pay any attention to what's going on around them. But this is a sort of a community where everyone can tell from what's going on over here what must be going on over there, and so forth. I never learned the language, unfortunately. Yes.
If you could read or write for the rest of your life, which would you do?
Fun?
If you could only read or only write for the rest of your life, which one would you do?
Right, of course. Because I don't do all that much reading. Oh, I do a lot of reading. I read a lot of trash and some that's very interesting. I said, man, he had a dry, rustling laugh like a snake heading at skin. I said, my God, that's good enough to steal.
What were you telling me yesterday about the control of the bestsellers? Because he does read a lot of trash. So he reads all the trash, the drugstore blockbusters.
Yeah, but someone must sort of orchestrate these things. You see, you have the CIA now. All the fiendish KGB people torturing people with blow torches and all like that. But you never have a story about the CIA doing these things. And the fiendish Arabs who, I remember one, he was a monster, used to take the chickens when he was a child and burn their heads off instead of cutting their heads off.
What novel was that? It was in Mossad.
Oh, the Mossads were so kindly and such beautiful people.
The Mossad is the Israeli secret police. So it's actually all the big bestseller blockbusters are part of the Cold War propaganda.
Absolutely.
You couldn't conceive of what it would
be. Very carefully orchestrated.
Yeah, I never read him myself, so but I know little I've dipped in, I noticed there is that bias.
I've read hundreds of them, enough to get the tendency, the tendacious nature.
Tendentious nature
that...
Has anybody noticed that?
That Arabs are fiends, that the Israeli are marvelous people, that the
Ruskies,
the Ruskies are also fiends, torturing, and that they push somebody into a cremation that alive. And all this sort of thing, and the CIA never did these sort of things.
Actually, that was a revelation when he said that, because I suddenly, a lot of things fell into place in my head. Because I'd looked at bestsellers occasionally, maybe, you know, one page.
These are not necessarily bestsellers. This is just a run of the mill of these paperback thrillers.
Does that include, like, those gold-leafed... The gold embossed paperback.
Yeah, like one was Doomsday Spiral. I've got Basham and I made notes. Mm-hmm. And
who do you like, Bill? You like Stephen King, though, don't you?
I just got so I couldn't stand him. I read. The Shining, which is sort of interesting because of Boulder, and the Stand. Yeah, but being here in the Stand. And then after that, I said, man, no, it's just getting too banal. And when a psychic novel gets too solid, you see, psychic phenomena shouldn't be so solid where tappery start walking around.
Yeah.
Defining the rules of psychic.
Where what starts walking around?
Tapestries.
Tapestries.
No, topiary.
Topiaries.
He had topiaries, lion topiaries running around and jumping on.
Sculpted bushes.
That just doesn't. It's violating the rules of what can happen in these areas.
Made the movie out of it.
The movie was not bad. I thought that he did a pretty good job of that. And then I saw the Dead Zone, so that was pretty good.
He was great, Walker.
Yeah.
Kid.
Yeah, but I didn't read the book.
I didn't read it either.
I saw the movie.
Should we invite him next?
The movie was good. Yeah, what?
I saw the documentary, Burroughs. It was playing in Chicago. And I was very impressed with the way you can handle weapons.
Yeah.
There's a part in the movie. And I was a little curious and wondering when you began your infatuation with weapons.
Oh, well, I was brought up with guns as a kid. And then I was away in Europe and places where I didn't have access to guns. Then I got back here, and now I'm back into weapons, and I go to a...
You got anything on you?
What?
You have your blackjack on you?
No. So then I go to the shooting range now, two or three times a week, and have a lot of fun.
I'm a good, as good a shot as the average cop. I can qualify. Much better, actually. Yeah, 50 feet, yeah.
Do you think a mace is like a weapon, street defense weapon?
It's, there's various kinds of mace. Some of it doesn't work on animals, psychotics, and animals, psychotics, and drunks. But then there's a kind that I've got that works on anything, and I guarantee it works if I use it on a dog.
Like cop mace, or?
Well, it's supposedly authorized for only, but I got some. I give this dog a squirt of it. Wow. Stop like you hit a stone wall. Yeah, it's a good weapon. It's one of the best because it's not lethal. You can use that if that. You should have a backup. If that don't work, you should have something else.
See, what struck me, around here, the Shambhala people are reading the Chinese book on the art of war. Do you know who is that?
No.
Sun Tzu.
Do you know that at all?
No.
It's sort of their realistic appraisal of strategies of war.
Yeah.
I found it interesting. Barbara Dilley was reading it.
Yeah.
And saying that she was, apparently there's a whole reading list of materials on warriorship and war that are being taught here as part of the Shambhala.
Yeah.
That sounded interesting. Up this alley of just a realistic relationship to the possible violence around you and how to relate to it without fear.
Well, there's all sorts of them. Improvised weapons, a sock, and a cake of soap is a good blackjack. But I've had very little actual trouble with bots. But if you're prepared to handle it, it's very, it becomes more unlikely that you will need to because you exude
confidence,
yeah.
Well, I live in a bad neighborhood in Denver, and I want some.
Well, isn't the mace? Mace
sometimes there's like three or four people giving you a stare.
Mace is very good. Mace is very good, and various forms of blackjacks.
Well, if we were to extrapolate this to the nuclear problem, how would you approach? Can you extrapolate?
You cannot extrapolate personal protection to nuclear. It just doesn't. Yeah. No, it doesn't go well.
Norman, but Horowitz does. He says that the United States has got to defend itself from being gang-banged by the Ruskies. So how do you see the nuclear? Mutual assured deterrence. Have you thought much about it? If you were president, what would you do? If you were vice president, what would you advise the president to do?
Excuse me. I am not vice president. Would never be vice president. If I was, I would have been a bound hand and put to do certain You just don't catapult yourself into this. I can, all right, I'll say, well, what the hell? First, let's cut out all this drug law nonsense and do this and do that. And by that time, I'd be dead. Talking about, you know, you don't, what would you do if you were president? You would never be president. If you had such ideas, you wouldn't have a chance. As to what you could do, say, on the nuclear war thing, I still don't know. It might be that the only solution would be to release biologic. A weapon that would make the whole thing
release a biologic weapon that would make the whole thing redundant. That is to say, a specific virus that would only get people who were interested in nuclear warfare?
No, it would not be that simple, but it would be a devastating pestilence, so there wouldn't be anybody to press the buttons, not to press the buttons. But
abolition of the human race.
Not necessarily.
To save the planet.
No, much less of an abolition of the human race than would occur with nuclear weapons, because there'd be plenty of survivors from a massive release of biological weapons, and they wouldn't. The whole environment would not be polluted. But I am not called upon to make such a heart-rending decision. Thank God.
Shall we wrap it up then?
Yeah.
Folks? One more?
Yeah. Mr. Brooks, I was wondering, you started writing about your drug addiction, and that's kind of how you got started. Have you ever found yourself putting yourself through perhaps an extreme situation for the sake of something interesting to write? How you reacted to being in that situation? Maybe something you would have normally done otherwise?
Well, no, I don't think you can put yourself through artificial situations. Is that what you mean?
Well,
an obstacle
maybe
course?
Maybe trying something that you wouldn't normally try that might be a bit extreme, say like...
Like what? Give me an example.
Let me think of something. Making dirty movies, I don't know.
Well, I thought of making dirty movies, but that's not very extreme. Get yourself in too much trouble that way.
What about the retreat?
Mm-hmm.
What about the retreat?
Retreats. Well, everybody said when I went to make the retreat, oh, you'll go nuts. Well, of course. This is ridiculous because, remember, our pioneer ancestors were often isolated in cabins for months at a time. And I found it very easy. In fact, I found it very pleasant to know that no one could call me on the phone or anything, and I was out there. I found it very easy. I could have been there much longer, but after a while it gets to diminishing returns. You know, you've gotten about as much as you can from isolation.
Unless you have a practice, actually. I found the longer I stay in, the deeper it gets and the more interesting the
more
silence.
Well, I didn't have any practice. I've got my own special.
You've got a lot of practices.
I've got my own special practices.
What are your most secret practice that you've never mentioned to anybody?
They aren't secret at all, but they're very hard to explain. It's simply cutting out all words in the mind. It's very difficult to do, and it's just lately that I've been able to accomplish.
Literally cutting out all talk in your head?
No talk.
Does anybody here that can do that?
It's difficult. It's difficult.
Anybody try?
Lots of people try. It's hard.
It's real hard.
Hard. Yeah. Well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Well.
So, what should we do now? I think maybe. Go.
Make a party.
We might as well go out. Do we want to do that Shelley thing, or should we save it for next time?
Next time.
Next time. How many want to save it for next time? How many want to do it now? Next time. Okay, let's adjourn the class. The next class, 7:30 Friday. Mailer may be present for that one. Up at the house.